On this particular day, this particular demon was having a pretty good day. I suppose as good a day as a demon can have. Everything was going just the way he wanted. He had control over a young girl, a place to stay, a body to inhabit. And he was carrying out his activities full speed ahead, unhindered. Now granted, there had been some chaos lately in the kingdom of darkness. They were experiencing defeat and actually casualties worse than any casualties that kingdom of darkness had suffered since the time of the flood. Even worse than the flood. But all those casualties, all those demons being cast out and the mayhem and the problem of just ravaging of the kingdom of darkness was mostly confined to Israel. But this demon wasn't in Israel. He was in a pagan place, living in a pagan home and inhabiting a pagan daughter of a pagan woman who was outside of God's covenant with Israel. And he was worshipped as a god. He was feared. And the more terror he brought to this girl, the more worship and fear he received from the people. And for him, everything was going just fine as far as he could tell. In fact, today was even better than average because this day, the mother was gone. Now, she was a pagan, but even pagan moms love their kids. And this woman is always in the demon's way. Taking care of the girl, comforting the girl, keeping her from injury, giving her hope. But today the mother is gone, and so today the demon would have free reign. This would prove to be an extraordinary day in the life of this demon. A day that I'm sure he remembers even now. But before I tell you what happened, let me just kind of set the scene. Look at verse 21 of Matthew 15. Leaving that place, Jesus withdrew to the region of Tyre and Sidon. I forgot to set up the map today, but you remember, you know the land of Israel. Tyre and Sidon is north of there along the coast. Tyre is 20 miles north. Sidon's another 20 miles north. And Jesus just walks up there. It'd be kind of like if you just said, decided this afternoon you're going to head up to the region of Berthoud and Fort Collins. That's about what it's like from here. So Jesus goes up there. Mark's account, verse 24, says he entered a house and did not want anyone to know it, and yet he could not keep his presence secret. Same old story. They're still trying for that day off. Remember? A couple months ago, or whenever it was, Jesus sent out his disciples for a short-term mission. They came back, they worked miracles, did all that stuff, and they came back. They wanted a report from Jesus, they wanted a debrief, they wanted to talk, they wanted rest. They needed some time alone to grieve the death of John the Baptist, but they couldn't get even a moment. The crowds were so relentless. They couldn't even eat. And so Jesus says, we need a day off. And so he decides to pile on the boat, go across the lake, over to the west side, to a remote place. They show up there, and there the crowds are again. And that day off turns into a whole long day of ministry. Jesus feeds the multitude, passes out the loaves and all that, and heals and everything. And then sends the disciples back across the lake. They get in the boat. They row against the wind all night long. They get stuck in the middle of the lake. Jesus walks out there. Peter walks on water, sinks. He gets them back. They get in the boat. The storm stops. Then he transports the boat back to the shore. See, you didn't have to come all summer. You could have just heard all this. Anyway, so now they're back on the shore, and there the crowd is again. And he heals them again, and he ministers to them again. And there's just no end to it. Then Jesus proceeds to offend absolutely everyone. He finds a way to offend the crowd. He offends the disciples, the larger group of disciples. He offends the scribes and Pharisees from Jerusalem. Even the 12, he was questioning whether they would leave, but under Peter's leadership, they stay. Israel now has effectively rejected Christ. We have just seen the pinnacle of his popularity, and at this point, they reject him. At this point, he turns away from Israel, turns away from the crowds, and more starts ministering just to the 12. It's really a turning point in the life of Jesus. And so now, that's all symbolized in the fact that he leaves Israel and goes up to Tyre and Sidon. Tyre and Sidon, if you want to just get an idea of what that means, you could pencil in there in your Bible, pagan land. The idea, maybe in pagan land we can get a minute to talk. But even there, they're interrupted. They get in the house, and people find out about it. And what's going to happen here is they're going to get interrupted. The disciples lose patience. Jesus responds in an absolutely shocking way. And then out of nowhere emerges one of the great heroes of the faith. So that's what we're in for this morning. You know, we all aspire to greatness. as we understand greatness to be. Whatever it is your concept of greatness is, that's what you're striving for. Whether you're conscious of it or not, that's what you're trying for. For a while there was a whole generation of people who wanted to be like Mike, you know, Michael Jordan, or whatever an entertainer is popular, or football star, whatever. That's the world. We are different as Christians. We aspire to greatness like they do, but we have our sights set on things far higher than being able to dunk from the foul line or whatever, dance and sing and so on. We look to the great heroes of the faith and we long to be like that. We see people that Jesus commends and we want nothing more than to be like that, to hear that commendation ourselves. And that's what we're going to see today. We're going to see one of those great heroes of the faith. Now, I should say, one of the most common mistakes that Bible teachers routinely make is to do character studies of Bible characters all the time and focus so that the focus is on people instead of God. That's a mistake. It's an error that we tend to do, and we should avoid that. However, there is one instance in which it's appropriate for us to study a person in the Bible and strive to follow that person's example, and that is when Scripture itself presents that person as being exemplary. When Scripture itself points us to that person and says, follow this example. And that's what happens here. So, this morning we're going to do two things. First, let's just watch. Let's just go through this story, let's just read through the story, and just enjoy it. Just sit back and enjoy the beauty of great faith. And then at the end we'll analyze it and compare it to other kinds of faith so that we can see what made this person's faith so great. So far, we've seen the disciples' weak faith, seen Peter's weak faith. We've seen the phony faith of the crowd who believes as long as they get free food. We've seen the temporary faith of the disciples that turned away, and we've seen the hardcore unbelief of the leaders from Jerusalem. Now we're going to see a whole other category. Great faith. Jesus calls it megalopistis, great faith. And it's the only place in the Bible where Jesus says that somebody has this. Only two places in the Bible where Jesus commends someone for astonishing level of faith. Both are Gentiles, and this is one of them. It comes from the most unlikely candidate from the most unlikely place. Tyre and Sidon, by referring to Tyre and Sidon, now he's basically in the region of Tyre, but Matthew mentions Sidon, and that mentioning of that calls to mind chapter 11 of Matthew, where Jesus used Tyre and Sidon, along with Sodom and Gomorrah, as illustrations of who's going to get the hottest hell on Judgment Day. People who are going to be judged very severely. So Tyre is a bad place. And in Jesus' time, the people of Tyre hated Jews. In fact, people all over Syria hated Jews, but in Phoenicia, but Josephus says that nobody hated the Jews like the people of Tyre. And that's where Jesus takes his disciples, right to Tyre. Look at verse 22. They're in Tyre now, and a Canaanite woman from that vicinity came to him crying out. Now he says a Canaanite. Mark's account in Mark 7:25 says, as soon as he heard about him, she heard about him, a woman whose little daughter was possessed by an evil spirit came and fell at his feet, and the woman was a Greek born in Syrian Phoenicia. Now you've heard this woman referred to as the Syro-Phoenician woman because she was born in Phoenicia, which is ruled by Syria. But you've also heard this story referred to as the Canaanite woman, the story of the Canaanite woman. And it just depends on whether you're reading Mark or Matthew. Mark just tells us where she's from. Matthew calls her a Canaanite. And that's fascinating because the thing you have to understand is there is no Canaan anymore. No such thing as a Canaanite. That's way back in the Old Testament time. That's Bible times for them. We look back 2,000 years to Jesus. They look back that far to the time of the Canaanites. So when Matthew calls her a Canaanite, he's trying to make a point here. It'd be like if I called somebody a Philistine. Obviously, I'd be trying to make some kind of a point because there are no Philistines anymore. Well, that's what Matthew's doing. So what's the point? What is a Canaanite? Very simply, a Canaanite. The Canaanites were the worst people in the Old Testament. They were the worst people in the Old Testament. They're the ones that corrupted Israel. They're the ones that lived in that land, in the land that became Israel before the Jews existed. And then the Jews came along and God promised that land to them. And when He did that, He told the Israelites, go in there and exterminate those people. Drive them out, destroy them, wipe out every man, every woman, every child, every animal, every bug, everything you can find, burn it, wipe it, get rid of every trace of that culture. That is extreme. God did not often do that in the Old Testament. But in this case, these people were so bad, so vile, so wicked, they were like a cancer on humanity and needed to just be excised. Well, we know the story. Israel didn't do it. And the reason for all the problems Israel had with idolatry is their failure to drive them out. They left them in there and they became influenced by them. And even up to the day of Jesus, they were still there, pagans in that area. What Matthew is saying is, by calling this woman a Canaanite, is that she is an illustration of leftover evil. Her very existence is a result of Israel's disobedience. And then by mentioning Sidon, remember what famous person in the Old Testament is from Sidon? Jezebel. That's what Sidon is known for. So Jesus leaves Israel and goes up to pagan land, and while he's there, up walks none other than Mrs. Pagan Land herself. Matthew might as well just call her Jezebel. This woman starts out, the point is, this woman starts out with like 10 strikes against her right off the bat. But she comes with a great concern. Look at verse 22. Canaanite woman came from that vicinity and came to him crying out, kradzo, yelling, literally yelling out, Lord, Son of David, have mercy on me. My daughter is suffering terribly from demon possession. That's amazing. She calls him Lord, Son of David. That is a very Jewish term for the Messiah. So ironic. While the Jews are rejecting Jesus, Jezebel from pagan land is referring to him as Lord, Son of David. People down in Israel have been given miracle after miracle, signs, wonders, supernatural acts beyond anything they've ever dreamed. They've been seeing that for 2 years now. They have heard his preaching and teaching. They've seen his life. They have seen the miracles. They even saw the heavens open up and the voice of God. They heard where he said, this is my son. How much more revelation could you have? And they respond by trying to stone him, saying he's demonic, ignoring him, or just wanting to use him for free food. But this woman, she has no scriptures, no godly teachers, she's outside of the covenant, she is not one of God's children, she has not seen the miracles, she's not heard the teaching and preaching, and she has been given almost nothing spiritually. And yet she believes as soon as she hears. And she comes to Jesus boldly, calling out to him, Lord, Son of David, and in humility asks him for mercy. Asking for mercy is a humble thing to do. She says her daughter is suffering terribly, which means that the wording there refers to a case of demon possession that's worse than average. You can imagine this woman just, before she left to find Jesus, standing over her daughter there, looking down at her precious little child and seeing the torment and the agony and the suffering, and you just feel the rock in her stomach. It's got to be the worst pain that a parent is capable of feeling to see your precious little one in the grip of the most wicked, vile, possible being who has total control over her. She comes to Jesus with a very great need. This is not a small request. People in Israel came wanting free breakfast. This woman comes with a serious need. Verse 23, look at Jesus' response. This is incredible. Jesus did not answer a word. Dead silence. You picture the scene? I mean, this woman is literally shouting, begging Jesus for help. Please, have mercy on me. Drive out this demon. And Jesus is completely ignores her. No response. Seems to be completely indifferent. This is quite an obstacle, to say the least. How's this woman going to respond? Now look at the next verse. You see her response. And the woman, when she saw this, turned away, just like the disciples had the day before, and she left him and said, fine, I'll go find myself a God who cares. Right? Is that what your version says? No, she doesn't do that. Great faith doesn't respond that way. And yet I've heard so many people who have turned away from God and who are bitter at God because they wanted Him to do whatever for them and He didn't snap to it in the way they wanted Him to and in their timing. God does not respond to people like that because He responds to faith. And that's not faith. Faith doesn't approach God that way. You say, God, You have to do what I want, when I want, the way I want. That's not faith, because if He does it, you don't need any faith. You can just go by sight. He's doing exactly what you've asked for. Faith has to be unconditional. It's not, God, I'll trust You if You do what I want, when I want. It's, God, I trust You, period, on Your terms. That's great faith. Well, Jesus responds with another obstacle, verse 23. Actually, the disciples give their own little obstacle, verse 23. So His disciples came to Him and urged Him, send her away, for she keeps crying out after us. This is really an amazing scene. The 12 are walking along. This woman's following behind, agitated, shouting. And the word urged, when the disciples urged Jesus, that's in the imperfect tense. They kept on urging Him. This is an ongoing thing. It just didn't happen in a moment. It's going on. She keeps shouting. The disciples keep on trying to get the Lord to send her away. And Jesus, just the whole time, is in dead silence, ignoring everything. And they're trying to get Him to respond. It's getting on our nerves, Lord. She's a pagan. She's a Gentile. She's a woman. Get rid of her. Dismiss her like You did in the crowd, in John 6. Just get her out of here. And what they're saying is, Lord, look, don't go traipsing off to her house like You always do when somebody comes with a need when we're about to have our meeting. Don't let us be robbed of that of You again. We need that time with You. Now, how do you suppose that made the woman feel? How would you feel? You're coming with this kind of an incredibly important need, your own daughter being tormented by a demon, and the only one who could possibly help shows up in town, and these men, His 12 representatives, they're saying, get her out of here. We don't want our retreat to be interrupted. We can see your response there in the next verse. It says, and when the woman heard what the disciples were saying about her, she turned away and stomped off in a rage, saying, the church is nothing but a bunch of hypocrites. I hate organized religion. I think I'll go worship by myself somewhere. Oh, I keep getting on the wrong page here. Sorry, that's not right. No, she doesn't do that either. And yet there's so many people today who do that. They've had some kind of bad experience with someone in the church. They had some negative thing happen to them. Somebody hurt them. And so they turn away from God and God's people and bail out of church thinking that they can approach God on their own terms. They imagine that they can enjoy the benefits of knowing God without the hassle of dealing with sinful people, imperfect Christians. Well, that's a fantasy. You can't do that. God has not given us that option. That's not God's plan. You cannot love God and ignore His people. You got to get along with us somehow or another. In verse 24, Jesus finally opens His mouth and speaks. And out of His mouth comes obstacle number 3. Verse 24, Jesus answered, I was sent only to the lost sheep of Israel. What is that? I was sent only to the... What does that mean? He's saying, I can't heal your daughter because you're not a Jew? Sorry, lady, wrong dispensation? What is this? Was Jesus unwilling to minister to Gentiles? No. He ministered to Gentiles from this very area before. Matthew 4:24, right before the Sermon on the Mount. It says, news about Him spread all over Syria. That's that same area. And people brought to Him all who were ill with various diseases, those suffering severe pain, demon-possessed, and those having seizures and the paralyzed, and He healed them. Jesus healed people from Syria. He didn't have any problem with ministering to people from Syria. He didn't have any problem ministering to non-Jews. Remember the woman at the well? In John 4, remember the centurion in Matthew 8? The other one with great faith? In fact, this is the very passage that marks Jesus' ending of His great Galilean ministry and starts His ministry in Gentile territory. So, who are the lost sheep of Israel? He can't grant her request because He's sent only to the lost sheep. What does that mean? It's not talking about the disciples. They're not lost. The disciples were the ones sent to the lost sheep also, remember back in chapter 10 when they were sent out on their mission. The lost sheep are the multitudes of Israel. Matthew 9:36, Jesus saw the crowd. He says, they're like sheep without a shepherd. They're the lost sheep, the crowds. in the Jewish people. And the point that Jesus is making is, he was willing to interrupt even this most important time with his disciples in order to minister to Jews, because that was still part of God, his calling. That still fit into his calling. His mission was to reach Israel, and he was going to do that through his disciples whom he needed to train. And he could not be sidetracked from that mission. In fact, you notice here he speaks of being sent. Of course, Jesus came into the world by his own free will. He was willing to do it, but what really mattered to him was the fact that God sent him to the world on a mission. And he never lost sight of his mission, and he never lost sight of his responsibility to the Father. He never thought in terms of his plans, his dreams, his hopes, his desires. He only thought in terms of his mission, his God-given mission, given by the Father. And he couldn't be sidetracked from that. He understood that if you spread your influence too thin, you waste it, you squander, you don't have any influence. You know, you're not called to do everything. Nobody can meet every need, not even Jesus in his earthly life. You can think of your life like a match. Life is short. It's like a little match, and you strike it and it burns out. And the goal is to warm the world. That's what we're here for. And you have two options. You can take your little match and hold it up and try and warm up the world, or you can use it to ignite some kindling and get that going so that before your life is extinguished, something else beyond you can get going and perpetuate your influence before you burn out. That's what Jesus did. And that's why he spent his ministry trying to get those 12 damp little sticks to ignite. And he did so, and they ended up reaching the whole world. That's why it's so important. Discipleship is so important. Pour yourself into somebody. Reproduce yourself. The things that you can do, make sure someone else can do those by the time you're gone. So, Jesus basically turns her down. He says, I'm sent only to the lost sheep of Israel. This is outside of my calling. It's outside of the purview of what I'm trying to accomplish. Well, look at the woman's response in the next verse. And when the woman heard this, she said, I have never been so insulted in all my life. I am going to find a religion that's not racist. I need a religion that deals with my culture and my heritage and appreciates that, and I'm going to find a God who appreciates my racial identity. No. Verse 25, her real response is there in verse 25, if you're wondering what the Bible actually says. Verse 25, the woman came and knelt before him. Proskuneo, face on the ground, worshipped. The word is worshipped. Jesus put all these barriers in front of her, and she didn't respond with anger, she didn't respond with despair, she didn't respond with pride, she responded with worship. Maybe she didn't like it. I imagine she didn't. I imagine she wasn't crazy about this whole setup with first the Jews, then the Gentiles later. But she doesn't complain about the arrangement. She doesn't complain about anything. She doesn't even question God's plan. She doesn't so much as ask why. She just worships, and then she says, Lord, help me. Mark says she begged Jesus to drive the demon out. She's persisting. Well then, Mark 7:27, Jesus says, first, let the children eat all they want. And then he goes on in verse 26 of Matthew 15, it's not right to take the children's bread and toss it to their dogs. I can't help you because it would be wrong for me to neglect the children for the dogs. Oh, now this is just getting painful. First he ignores her, then the disciples want to send her away, and then he gives her some kind of a racial comment, and now he calls her a dog. Is Jesus trying to reach this woman or what? What kind of evangelistic technique is that? Jesus just being rude here? I read one commentary said that. Jesus is being very rude. Dogs ran in packs and scavenged in the garbage dumps, and they were the epitome of uncleanness and vileness. And to call someone as a dog was just a massive insult. Sometimes the Jews called Gentiles dogs to show their utter contempt and to say that they had no owner and they were unclean and all that. But that is not what Jesus is saying here. He uses a different term. He uses a diminutive form, which means little dog. It'd be like, and it's a reference to house pets. It could be translated puppies. And it's clear from the context, he's talking about a house pet, not a wild dog. It's not an insult, it's just an illustration. The disciples are the children. Jesus' mission is to work with them, and he understands that there's a lot of people, he understands what a lot of people in ministry don't understand, and that is, it isn't right to neglect your calling in order to get some other pressing need over here that's outside of your calling. It wouldn't be right to interrupt the feeding of the disciples to help someone else. You see, it's not cruelty to animals to give preference to your kids at dinner time, right? That's one of the privileges of being a child in the house. You get fed before the dog. I certainly hope. I mean, I hope you're not cruel to your pets, but I also hope you give some preference to your children over your pets. That's not cruel, it's normal, and there's absolutely nothing out of place about it. The children's bread is the time and attention of the Lord. It's spiritual sustenance and teaching from the Lord. It's His time. And He wants to feed His 12. He's making a statement about priorities. It would be wrong for Him to just jump up every time there's a need and go running off to help, just like it would be wrong for me to neglect my family and my children for some other task. Now you might be thinking, well, wait a minute. Jesus did that the last time they had a day off. He was going to spend a day off with the disciples, and then He saw the crowd and had compassion on them, and He ended up neglecting His disciples. That's true. But remember, He said, that's the point of verse 24, I'm sent only to the lost sheep of Israel. He sees those lost sheep. That's still within His calling. It's still within His mission. He'll interrupt that important time for that, but not for this. Now, verse 27. When the woman heard this, she turned away and said, oh well, I guess it's not God's will. I asked and I didn't get what I asked for, so I give up. And she quit. No. She plows right through this barrier too. But look how she does it. Take a look at verse 27. Look how she does it. Yes, Lord, she said. Isn't that beautiful? Oh, I love that. I just love that. If we could just learn to say that, we would learn, if we could learn one thing from this woman, this great hero of the faith, if we just learned to say that, we would be learning a lot, wouldn't we? When this kind of thing happens, and God responds this way for whatever reason, we just respond, yes, Lord. Some bitter, devastating, painful trial comes and keeps coming, and we just say, yes, Lord. This is one of the greatest stories in the Bible, I think, on learning how to interact with the Lord on His terms. It's just a shock to us sometimes when we find out what God's terms are, isn't it? I mean, we read the story and we think, wow, not what I would expect. It's all about His terms. It's not our place to argue. It's not our place to question. It's just our place to say, yes, Lord. Yes, Lord. One of the greatest tragedies of the modern church is that we have managed to send the message to this world that somehow they can approach God on their own terms. People who believe that are in for a rude awakening when they actually meet up with the Lord. Jesus set some very difficult terms for this woman, and the reality is, she really is the last priority. The disciples, ministering to the disciples is ahead of her. Ministering to the crowds in Israel is ahead of her. But she responds not with despair or anger, but with a positive affirmation, because like Mary at the wedding at Cana, she sees a hidden yes embedded in Jesus' no. Let me show you what I mean. There's a hole in Jesus' argument. A hole that He purposely left there, and it's a hole that very few people would be able to spot. Only great faith can spot it. Jesus gave an argument to this lady that was unanswerable, except for one point of vulnerability in the argument. But before we talk about the point of vulnerability, that hole in the argument, let me show you one other beautiful thing about what Jesus said that is somewhat hidden in verse 7. It's that first word in verse 27. I don't want to go any farther without calling your attention to that. We should circle that word. We should highlight it, underline it. That is a precious word for us, that first word. The word first. You see why? How many of you are Gentiles? If you're not a Jew, you're a Gentile. Okay? If you're a Gentile, that word first is precious. Because what does that imply? First the children, what does that imply? Then the house pets, then the rest. It implies if there's a first, that there's a second. If Jesus just said, no, let the children eat, period, that would be tragedy for us. It would mean God's grace would extend only as far as the Jews, and that's it. But we can rejoice over that word first, because the implication is first the Jews, then the Gentiles, then us. And by using the term for a pet dog, what Jesus is doing is gathering up all of the Gentiles and bringing them under the same roof as the Jews. Bringing us under the same roof, into the family, with the disciples. That word dog is precious for that reason. The Jews use the term for wild dogs to refer to Gentiles, but by using this word for pets, Jesus domesticates the entire Gentile world, brings us into His house, potentially. You see the masterful way Jesus is organizing His life? The first half of the chapter, if you were last week, and this part, it's all a cohesive unit. First, Jesus makes all foods clean. Then He goes up into pagan land and makes all people clean. All right, so let's go back to the whole in Jesus' argument. No one up to this point has ever prevailed against Jesus in a debate. But this woman finds a way. One old commentator suggests what may have taken place in the woman's mind as she realizes that Jesus intentionally left this weakness in His argument as to why He can't help. Quote, here's what he says, quote, His own illustration has admitted her right to profit by the heedlessness of the children. And He had admitted all this. He had meant to be thus overcome. One loves to think of the first flush of hope in that trembling mother's heavy heart as she discerned His intention and said within herself, oh, surely I'm not mistaken. He does not really refuse at all. He wills that I should answer Him and prevail. One supposes that she looked up, half afraid, to utter the great rejoinder, and took courage when she met His inviting gaze. And so she speaks. And the next word in the NIV is but. That is not in the Greek. There's no adversative. It's not Allah, it's not de, it's neither one. It's the word gar, for. An explanatory gar. She's explaining, yes, Lord, for. It doesn't get translated that way because I think there may be a misunderstanding that translators have in the flavor of what she's saying. She doesn't phrase her answer as an argument at all. She just accepts what Jesus says totally. She's saying, what you said, Lord, is absolutely true. This thing about the dogs being a lower priority than the children, absolutely true. I accept that 100%. She doesn't argue. She doesn't argue and say, well, make my needs an exception. Or, you know, I should have the right to Israel's covenanted mercies. Or, you know, the mysterious plan of God in favoring one nation over the others is unfair. No, she doesn't argue any of that. Instead, she just says, yes, Lord. By the way, you know, in the entire book of Mark, this is the only time anybody ever refers to Jesus as Lord. This woman. See, when Jesus uses the analogy of children and pet dogs, His point is that the disciples are the priority. It would be wrong to neglect them for someone else. And if you were the woman, what would you say to that? How would you respond to that? What are the possible responses? Most people could only think of two possible responses to that. Number one, either you disagree and say, no, the disciples shouldn't be the priority. You should attend to me. And you should, you know, they could argue that way. You'd lose, but you could argue that way. Or on the other hand, the only other possibility, it seems, is that you could agree and say, you're right, the disciples are the higher priority. I guess I'll have to just wait. It seems like the only two options. But great faith finds a third option. Verse 27, look at what this lady says. Yes, Lord, she says, for even the dogs eat the crumbs that fall from their master's table. That is a brilliant argument. This lady is incredibly sharp and a quick thinker. Let me show you the genius of her response. She picks up on Jesus' analogy and uses it. And the thing that's so great about her reply is the fact that there's faith. You know, some people said, Jesus, you know, what's the thing that's great about her reply is Jesus was rude and she didn't get mad, and that's great faith because she handled rudeness. Some others have said, well, she agreed that she was a dog, and that shows humility, and that's what's great about it. That's fine. I mean, it's good to be humble, but the greatness of her response goes way beyond that. Most people are like the guy in John 4 who traveled to Capernaum and Cana and told Jesus from Capernaum to Cana and said, beg Jesus to come to his house and heal his son. Please come so you can heal him. And Jesus did. He came and healed him. Most people think that Jesus has to be there on site in order to do a healing. But this woman has great faith. She understands who Jesus is. She understands that Jesus is God. And unlike the disciples, it's no problem for her to assume that Jesus can behave like God. She figures if the problem is that he doesn't want to neglect his disciples and come to my house, if that's the problem, he just doesn't want to neglect them, that is a non-problem. It's a non-problem because he can help me without neglecting his disciples at all. Just like you can feed your dog without neglecting your children at all because they drop the crumb. She points that out using Jesus' own analogy. In the pet dog analogy, it's not necessary to neglect the children to feed the dog. Both can be done simultaneously without any effort, extra effort at all, without any extra expense. Anyone with young children and a dog understands why, right? We used to have to sweep our kitchen floor after supper. Now we don't because we have a dog. And when they're getting a little better now, a little more dexterous, but when our children were younger, there was never any need for any dog to be fed if they were around our house. When our kids were little, any dog that was around was a very well-fed dog because there was just a continual meal of food being rained down on the floor like manna from heaven during a whole meal. And Mark, I don't know if Mark had children or what, but that's in Mark's account, he calls them the children's crumbs because he knows what he's talking about here. No matter how poor you are, it doesn't cost you anything to let the dog eat the crumbs, right? Those crumbs, what are you going to do with those crumbs? You'll just sweep them up, throw them away if you don't have a dog. It doesn't cost you anything. You see what she's saying? She's saying, Lord, you don't have to neglect your disciples to feed me. You don't have to leave them and come to my house. Stay seated. Just stay with them. Don't even take a moment. All it takes is a word. All it takes is a thought. Just think the thought. Just say the word. Demon will be gone. I know that'll happen. I know you have that power. She's assuming he can behave like God. She's recognizing he's God. You don't have to come to my house. The word she uses for crumb is also in the diminutive form. It's an especially little crumb. All this woman wants is the smallest fragment of a leftover crumb of God's grace. She says, that's all I need. And her point is, Lord, what I'm asking you is not going to cost you anything. It's not going to use any of your time. She realizes he's not just another prophet who can come and do miracles. He is God. And that's what Jesus commends. That is great faith. And as soon as she says that, everything changes. Look at verse 28. Look at Jesus in verse 28. Then Jesus answered, woman. And this marks a turning point in the story. Jesus' tone completely changes. All the pronouns change to be very, very personal. Jesus, and literally there's the word oh there. Literally Jesus says, oh, woman. As if he's overcome with emotion. Up to now, Jesus has seemed so distant and detached. And now, suddenly, he's so tender and warm. He says, oh, woman, you have great faith. One of the rare times Jesus ever recognizes human greatness. And then the next line in Matthew's account is, your request is granted. And that's also another amazing phrase. You know what that says in the Greek? Literally, it will be done for you as you will. She didn't argue with God's program, God's will. She accepted God's will, and as a result, God granted her will. In faith, we seek God's will, and in favor, He grants ours. We say, your will be done, and very often God will respond by saying, okay, your will be done. But only after we submit to His. You know, whenever the most brilliant minds in Israel tried to gang up on Jesus and trap him in an impossible question, he trapped them. No matter whom Jesus is up against, he always easily wins every conflict. Nobody can out-argue him. But he allows himself to be persuaded by this woman. That's the power of great faith. Don't let the fact that you knew the end of the story detract from the beginning of the story. Keep your attention from the beginning of the story. The fact is, this woman came with a request and Jesus refused her. Turned her down. The answer was no. If she would have left after Jesus' initial remarks, I don't think Jesus would have run after her and said, "Oh, wait up, I was just kidding." It would have just been refused. She just wouldn't have. There are blessings that God is willing to give only if you demonstrate persistent, fervent prayer and great faith. How many blessings does God offer us that we leave unretrieved because we give up? Verse 28, "You have great faith, your request is granted." Mark's account says, "Then he told her, 'For such a reply, you may go, the demon has left your daughter.'" It's all because of her reply. She instantly got everything she wanted just because of her reply. And Matthew says that the girl was healed at that right then, from that very hour. Demon was gone. The moment Jesus spoke those words, demon was gone. I like to think about this from the perspective of the demon. I don't know if you've ever thought about that. I mean, he's just having a great day. Everything's fine. The mother's gone. He can do whatever he pleases. He's just carrying on, terrorizing this girl, doing whatever demons do. And there's no sign of danger. There's no sign of anything wrong. There's no one trying to cast him out. He's just, everything's fine. Then just suddenly, out of the blue, without any warning, blindsided. Bam! He's gone. Just like that. And I don't know how Jesus did it. I'd love to know. I don't know if the demon just suddenly realized he has to go, or if he experienced some unbearable terror, or some angel came, or if he just suddenly found himself elsewhere, like Jesus just chucked him across the solar system, or what. But I'll tell you what very likely happened. Based on our study of the 2,000 demons and the pigs, one second this demon is doing whatever he wanted, and the next second, Jesus gave the command, he found himself enclosed forever in the bottomless pit, the lake of fire, the place that those 2,000 demons begged Jesus not to send them and where he sent them anyway. The 2,000 at least had a chance to beg for mercy, not this one. He's just, boom, he's gone. Before he even knows what's happening, he's forever locked in eternal judgment and maddening torment. Jesus thinks, one thought, demon is gone. One less demon, just like that. So much for the gods of the nation against Christ. In comparison with the mighty Christ, not even the fiercest, most powerful demon can withstand his wrath even for one split second. Which came as no surprise at all to the woman. She fully expected that Jesus could do that. Now, what an event. Jesus leaves the Holy Land and finds great faith in the daughter of an accursed race. So let's wrap up this time by just reminding ourselves of these characteristics of great faith. I want to list them out for you here so that you can have them in your head. 6 ingredients for great faith. You ready? Number 1, great faith comes through hearing. The whole thing started in verse 25 when the woman heard about Jesus. She doesn't see the miracles firsthand. She didn't walk on water. She didn't see Jesus cast out 2,000 demons into pigs or the storm, still the storm, or provide bread for the multitude. She didn't see any of that. She just heard about Jesus from reliable testimony and she believed. Romans 10:17. Faith comes through hearing the message. You want someone to be saved? You got a loved one you want to be saved? Continue to present the gospel. Faith comes from hearing the gospel. Just proclaim it. That's why we do what we do. That's why we just preach verse by verse by verse by verse. There's other ways we could attract a crowd, but we're not interested in that. We're interested in generating faith, and faith comes from hearing the Word. Number 2, great faith is humble and reverent. And by the way, if you want to have great faith, immerse yourself in the Word. Listen to it. And submit to it. Number 2, great faith is humble and reverent. This woman approached him with reverence and spoke to him with respect. Even when he made it very hard to do so. That's just so missing in our culture, isn't it? As you go to different worship things, it just can become so shallow. So many of the modern, I mean, there's some wonderful modern choruses, but some of them, oh, they're just so irreverent. I heard one praise song that has the line, "You are the salt on my Fritos." What's that? That is just profane. That's not worship. I don't know what kind of a being these people think they're worshiping with, writing stuff like that. That's one thing I love about about what Terry's doing and the work he does here. I mean, did you see the songs we sang today? They just point you to God. This is not "you are the salt on my Fritos" stuff. I mean, this is exalted thought. You can take this. This is stuff you should take this home every week. You should fold this up, put it in your pocket, and use this in your prayer time. Use it to help you at the beginning of your prayer time when you're just in your praise mode. You need to have a sense of reverence when we come to God. That's great faith. Number three, great faith is unconditional. It seeks God on His terms. It doesn't say, "God, I'll believe if you perform." So many of you can identify with this woman because the Lord has dealt with you the same way. Can't you identify with that? So many of you, I know your story. I know that God has dealt with you the same way. And so often God's terms seem unreasonable, completely unreasonable. And the testing seems to go way too long and appears to be way too hard. You know why? Because great faith is not exposed through easy tests. It requires a hard test to expose great faith. Number four, great faith is persistent. It persists through any barrier. Jesus is silent, she persists. The disciples are rude, she persists. Jesus gives their statement about mission to the lost sheep, she just plows through that. Jesus says the disciples are the priority, she keeps plowing around through that. She keeps on persisting all the way to the end. And that's the important part. The only kind of faith that's any good at all is the kind that persists all the way to the end. Peter was rebuked. Think about this. Peter was rebuked because his faith didn't make it all the way to the end. He had incredible faith. He walked on water. He had faith strong enough to walk on water all the way from the boat to within arm's reach of Jesus. He had that much faith, and Jesus rebukes him for having little faith because he didn't quite make it all the way. Great faith makes it all the way. The faith of the disciples that turned away earlier in the chapter wasn't faith at all. They just turned away when Jesus became too demanding. When he started getting too narrow, they got out. This woman would not get up. She cannot be diverted from the rock-solid confidence in the Lord. That's great faith. And Jesus, when He sees great faith in the heart, He always exposes it. He wants everyone else to see it. He exposes the absence of faith. He exposes the presence of faith. He exposes the strength of strong faith, the weakness of weak faith, and the greatness of great faith. That's what trials are all about, and so many other things in life, is to expose that so everyone else can see what He can see. When you ever find Jesus doing something very odd in the Gospels, chances are that's what He's doing. He starts dealing with someone in a very strange way. Just ask yourself, is it possible that He's trying to expose the nature of this guy's faith? And when you ask that question, almost always the story just opens up and you can understand everything that's going on. That's what Jesus is doing. Seems odd or cruel sometimes, His behavior. But at the end, you can see exactly what He's doing. He's putting her great faith on display for the church to see for the centuries to come. And just like you might hold up a brilliant diamond and turn it to see it in different light and to see the different sides and facets, that's what Jesus is doing with this woman's faith. He just wants to see the light refract off all the edges of it, and He keeps showing, bringing different tests to show the strength of it. And Matthew contrasts this woman's great faith with Peter's little faith. Chapter 14, Jesus says, "You have little faith," to Peter. In chapter 15, He says, "Great is your faith," to the woman. Peter walked on water. This woman just made a remark. You see, it's hard to tell how great faith is until it's tested. You can't tell. That's why the testing is so crucial. Who would have thought? Who would have ever dreamed that Peter was walking on water by means of little faith? And who would have thought this uncouth, screaming, pagan woman, Jezebel land woman, would have great faith? Not seen until the testing comes, and the testing shows hers to be great and Peter's to be little. Some of you appear to have great faith, and you're walking along just fine. Maybe you're walking on water. I mean, you're doing phenomenal things to the Lord. But just because you're walking on water, don't imagine it's because your faith has no weakness. It could be that your faith is little, it just hasn't been tested sufficiently. So I love this quote from Spurgeon. He said, "Rest assured, brethren, that between here and heaven, we shall need every ounce of faith we have." You can do great things through little faith, but the problem with little faith is it can be made to look away from Christ, like Peter did. Nothing could divert this woman's confidence from the Lord. We see her cling to Jesus all the way through the story like a drowning person clutching a life raft. That's great faith. Are you clutching Christ like that? Has your faith found a resting place? Is it attached to the anchor behind the veil in the most holy place in heaven? Are you utterly persuaded of God's power and goodness no matter how you feel? No matter how you feel? The only way you can be able to do that is if you understand the true nature of God. And quickly, that's the last two. Great faith has unlimited confidence in Jesus' kindness. Even when it appeared that He was being unkind, she bowed before Him and said, "Help me, Lord." Still looked to Him as her source of help. Faith believes that God is good even when emotion isn't so sure. People who get angry at God do that because when painful things come, they assume God is not being good. They're not fully persuaded of God's goodness. They can't see how it can be good, and therefore it can't be good because they can't see it. And number six, great faith has unlimited confidence in Jesus' ability, His power. The only people who are said to have great faith believe that Jesus could heal from a distance. Every failure in faith always traces back to doubting one of those two things, Jesus' goodness or Jesus' power. That's why we spend so much time in Genesis 1, just shortly after starting this church, because I wanted you to understand Jesus' goodness and God's goodness and God's power. Because I knew that if you understand that, if you have unshakable confidence in His power and His goodness, you have unshakable faith. Absolutely unshakable faith. That's why we sing songs like "Great is Thy Faithfulness," because we understand that we'll never have great faith until we understand His great faithfulness, the fact that He's worthy of it. We'll never trust as we should until we're convinced of His trustworthiness. And that's why this last point is the greatest point of all, because the real wonder isn't that somebody would have great faith like this. The real wonder is that there is someone worthy of that caliber of faith. Another way to say that is, the key to having great faith is to have a great object for your faith and to understand the greatness of that object.